Welcome to the Next Level Income Show, where it's our goal to raise your income, investments, and your life to the next level. I'm your host, Chris Larson. You can get a free copy of our book and new audiobook at nextlevelincome.com/book. You're not going to want to miss today's show with Chris Bennett. Chris is a self-storage specialist, and he's going to share with you why self-storage is not only a great investment today, why it's going to be a great investment into the future, and how his group uses demographics and technology to add value, find great deals in this space, and share them with investors. On today's show, we have Chris Bennett of PassiveInvesting.com. Chris has 14 years of real estate experience spanning self-storage and residential investment and brokerage. At PassiveInvesting.com, his responsibilities include sourcing self-storage deals and leading due diligence. Chris has been a guest speaker at the North Carolina Self-Storage Association and UNC Kenan Flagner Business School Executive MBA and undergraduate real estate classes. Chris is a graduate of UNC Chapel Hill and the Kenan Flagler Business School, where he served as a fund manager for the school's real estate investment fund. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited. Enjoyed catching up a little bit here before the show. And, you know, we're coming off the back of the self-storage summit here you did a couple of weeks ago. Phenomenal event. So for anyone that missed that or hasn't kind of heard about you and your part in PassiveInvesting.com, maybe you could share a little bit about your background and how you ended up in the self-storage space.
Absolutely. So we'll go back in time to 2007. Got my real estate license. My first day on the job as a brand new residential real estate broker was August 20th, 2007. Lo and behold, nobody ever knew. Yeah, that was a great foresight, right? Nobody knew what was coming in 2008. Our real estate class was packed. I mean, 150 people or whatever. So we're all going to be rich and go kill it with, you know, Robert Kiyosaki wisdom. But anyway, so obviously 2008 hit. I was actually working in the foreclosure side of the business, which was both good and bad. Yeah, so I worked with a few investors who could pay cash for deals. And if you could buy stuff back then, obviously, you know, and hold it for the next 10 years, you'd be a multimillionaire. But nobody knew, right? We were all going through a really hard time. And it was the worst time to be a real estate agent, like the last, I don't know, 25, 50 years, something like that. So shot ourselves in the foot during that time. But anyway, so fast forward, I got kind of tired of the business. I was evicting people and doing all kinds of stuff with banks and asset managers. It was not fun. I was the boots on the ground kind of guy. So yeah, just didn't want to do that any longer. So I decided to go to school. I was a bit older. I was in my, I think, early 30s. I want to say, I can't remember now exactly, but somewhere around there. Went to community college here, that area. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. Ended up transferring to UNC Chapel Hill. They have a real estate program there that I didn't know about at the business school when I got Chapel Hill. Coincidentally, I didn't want to do anything with real estate. I wanted to go do something completely different just because I had seen all the bad stuff from real estate and didn't understand fully investing in the opportunity that presented itself. Could I go back? If I could go back in time, obviously I do things a little bit differently, but it's okay. It works out. So I got to the business school, applied to the real estate fund that they have there. Oh, and I'll back up for a quick second. It's funny. I got to Chapel Hill. I was looking for summer work after my first year there. And the only job I could find on the job boards at the school was for a real estate private equity fund based in Chapel Hill. If you guys don't know, Eller Capital, Daniel Eller. Anyway, I interned there for that summer and then the following summer. And I realized that, oh my gosh, this guy goes and buys, I had no idea what he did. He goes and he buys apartments and he raises capital, do these deals. And he was looking at a portfolio of like 16 apartments at the time in the North Carolina area. I was helping him underwrite it. I didn't know anything about underwriting. I'd never seen so many zeros in the purchase price of a property in my life, you know, so it was like millions of dollars. And I was just astounded by what he was doing. And so that was my first exposure really to syndication, raising capital and buying apartments. So anyway, I applied to, they have a real estate fund at the school. I applied to that and got on as a fund manager. We were taking friends and family money. We had about into a fund platform, I guess you'd say. It was fund number three. Yeah, it was $3.6 million is what we had at the time of LP money. And this is real money, high net worth individuals, friends and family of the business school. So it was really an honor to be a part of that program and to be a fund manager. But we invested in hotel, self-storage, multifamily, a bunch of other stuff. And it was really cool to see these deals. We were a small piece. We put in like $250,000 on average. And these guys are raising like 10 times that to do a big development or whatever. So it was really cool to see that. Anyway, worked at a graduate at an office, a family office, I call it, up in the Raleigh area. We were tasked with looking for multifamily deals. And I couldn't make the numbers work with the return we're trying to target and the economy at the time. This is about 2016. Things were pretty hot at that time. If you think they're hot now, they are. They were hot then and it was going like up in a sense, like a rocket ship. But anyway, so we pivoted to self-storage and I can compare the underwriting of the two and the operation and all this stuff. And I was like, wow, this is, this is a great opportunity in the storage space. And so we put together a fund, we raised money on crowdstreet.com and we went out and purchased a good number of self-storage facilities and closed them obviously and completed that whole, the fund one is what we called it. I ended up moving back to Charlotte to be closer to friends and family. My wife is, her family's in the area. So we moved back here. I partnered with some other guys to do some single family home development and look for self-storage deals. Then fast forward a little, met my partner, John. I kept in contact with Dan Hand from his very first meetup that he ever had when he was getting into the business before they owned anything. And he even met Brandon and anybody else. He had a meetup in Charlotte. I don't even know how I connected with him, but I got invited to the first meetup and it was me and Dan and like three or four other people. I just kept going because it kind of made sense to go and connect with people, even though I was interested in storage and not really multifamily. So he and I stayed in touch, you know, that was 2+ years ago, something like that. And we stayed in touch since that time. He contacted us and my other partner, John, and said, hey, we want to do storage. You guys are doing storage. Let's talk. So we did. It made sense to kind of merge the two companies together and we came in under the passive investing umbrella. And that was in January of this year. So that's kind of where we're at right now. And that's my story, I guess, in a big nutshell.
That's a good size nutshell. Yeah, so it's fantastic. And that's one of the things that I like about you, Chris, is you've done more than just self-storage. You have a view of the market. And it is. That's when we did our first syndication in 2016. And it was hot then and it's gotten a lot hotter, but it's very dynamic now, obviously, with a lot of different things. So I guess, you know, as somebody who's seen both pieces, who's underwritten both pieces, talk a little bit about some of the similarities and then also the differences between multifamily and self-storage.
Yeah, sure. So I guess let's start with the differences because it's a little bit easier to think of it that way. Yeah. One is like, for example, the rents on self-storage. Let's say, let me back up for a quick second. In apartments, you might rent in it for, let's say it's $1,000 per month and it's 1,000 square feet. So that's $1 per foot in rent, right? In revenue. In storage, you might have a 10 unit. That's 100 square feet. And you can rent that for $1 per month as well. So in that sense, they're similar. You might get close number in square footage, right? As far as $1 per foot or revenue per foot, but you actually bring in is drastically different, right? $1,000 versus $100 a month is a very different amount of money. People sometimes don't realize that when they're going from multifamily to storage, but that can also be a pro because the prices in general for self-storage and the number of units that you can get is less than in multifamily, right? So if you had $1 million or something like that, you can go buy maybe a $5 million apartment complex, something like that, right? And you might get, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 units, you know, I don't know, depends on where it is. You take that same $1 million, you want to go buy a $5 million project in self-storage, well, you can probably buy 300 units in self-storage. Yeah. So the revenue can be similar on a per foot basis. The actual dollar amount that you get and that you make is less, obviously, in storage as far as total dollars are concerned, but you can buy more units with the same amount of equity. So your vacancy risk is a little bit different. If you have those 20, you know, let's call it 20 units in multifamily, 2, 3, 4 of those go dark, getting real close to your break-even point, right? Now you're getting in trouble, maybe. Whereas in storage, you know, a 15% occupancy is considered stabilized. So your break-even point is much, much less around, maybe let's call it, it could be around 40% to 50% or so. You can lose a lot more of your tenant base in self-storage and be okay versus multifamily. So there's more multifamily deals to look at, right? If you take Charlotte, for example, you go on apartments.com, just type in, you know, what you're looking for, 2, 3, you know, something like that, apartment. I mean, you'll find a lot, right? There's a lot of those, but you go, there's only like roughly, let's call it plus or minus 400 storage facilities in all of Charlotte. In the MSA. So it's a lot less, right? As far as numbers. So trying to find a deal that works and makes sense can be a little bit tricky, you know, in the self-storage space. So there's a ton of pros and cons that we can, you know, talk about further, but those are kind of the big ones that people sometimes don't, I guess, realize or think through.
Yeah. So, you know, in my book, I talk a lot about the demographic trends that are supporting multifamily this decade. You know, how we're not building enough units. You have millennials that are renting in bigger numbers. And I think the pandemic last year, you know, if you couldn't buy, then, you know, it's, you're probably going to continue to rent as you save up that down payment that you might have, you know, you might have had to spend last year. We have baby boomers that are selling their homes to unlock their equity, especially in this hot seller's market, and they're renting. Talk a little bit about the demographic trends that support self-storage.
Well, we're a nation of, I was going to say hoarders, but that isn't fair. We're a nation who likes to buy stuff, right? Yeah. And I see nothing wrong with that. Yeah, we're consumer, we're consumption-driven economy, and there's nothing wrong with that. I like it. It's fine. I want to have 25 different choices of shampoo when I go to the store. I don't want two. So it's totally fine by me. However, we fill up our homes and we realize, oh man, we need more room for whatever it might be, you know, whether it be Christmas decorations and just grandpa passed away, sadly enough, but we need to put his stuff somewhere and I can't bring myself to get rid of it, you know, stuff like that. So it's just a matter of, hey, we put things that we don't want to get rid of. We have an emotional attachment to those things sometimes. And then at the same time, we like to move. You're talking about people who are possibly downsizing, right? So right now I live in a 2,700 square foot house and I think about my kids and they grow up and all that. Am I going to want to live here when I'm older? Not really. You know, I'm going to want to downsize my home just like you had mentioned. So, but some things I don't want to get rid of. I need to put it somewhere in storage. And so that's where storage comes into play. It's kind of funny. We bought this house. It was a former model home and it came fully furnished. So the stuff you see behind me, if you're watching this on YouTube or whatever, you can't see it on the podcast. See, but I had like some bookshelves behind me. These were here when I moved in. Like all, we could literally have just packed our luggage and just moved into the house. It was fine. It was,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it
I like that idea. So we just finished building our house, and I will tell you what, you know, that buying furniture, the interior designer that it's, my wife worked with, I probably could have bought, actually, I know I could have bought the original property I bought with cash when I was in college. So it's wild.
It's funny. Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. So yeah, so we were really blessed to have that happen. But then there's some pieces of furniture that we're selling off. For example, we have up in the one of the rooms upstairs, and I'm going somewhere with this. One of the rooms upstairs has a nice dresser in it. I looked it up to see how much it costs, and it's about $1,000 dresser. Yeah. Girls' a ladies' dresser. Yeah. Soft closed doors. I mean, it's nice. It weighs 200 pounds. We're going to sell it. And in my mind, I'm like, I don't want to sell this. I want to put it in storage. Like, I don't want to get rid of it. But then I think about, why am I going to do that? Because I don't want to keep holding that stuff. Exactly. So we're going to sell it and do nails with the money. But the point is people kind of think along those lines. If I'm downsizing, if I lost a job, which we see some of that happening, obviously last year with the pandemic, moving. I got friends right now, they're selling their homes and they're actually moving into rent for now temporarily to pay down some debt, need some place to put their stuff. Right. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but that's their financial situation right now. They need some place to put their stuff. So it goes into as a result. So we're very mobile, you know, workforce and economy, and folks like to move and buy stuff. And so that kind of drives some of the demand for self-storage.
I'm not a big stuff guy. Like, I consider myself more of a minimalist. My wife, it drives her crazy because every quarter I go through my closet and I like donate clothes. And she's
dude,
like,
just like that. Yes.
Yeah. So it's kind of ironic that, you know, you and I are talking about self-storage. But when we were in the DC market, we had a self-storage unit right across the street because there wasn't like garage space. I've always been a cyclist and we keep some things over there. When we were building our house, we used one of the pods, which you're probably familiar with, which is kind of a cool thing. But I can see if we had a storage unit, how we might have left some stuff in there.
Absolutely.
Also, depending on how we did it. So you know, I think if you're listening to this, you're probably thinking, I've used self-storage or I have a unit right now, you know, that I'm using. So it's really interesting. And I don't think this trend is slowing down as people are now saying, hey, I can live and work wherever. They get to move around. We have people in Asheville renting our Airbnb. They're coming and staying for a week or so at a time and testing the market to see if they want to live here. And they're kind of doing that all around the country. It's really cool. Yeah. So they've sold their house. I just talked to a woman last week. They're selling their house out west and they're traveling for, so what are they going to do with their stuff, right? They're going to put it in storage.
It's got to go in storage.
Yeah. And these are all, you know, affluent people that are making these choices. It's really interesting. So Chris, you live in Charlotte. You were just talking about the Charlotte MSA with respect to the number of self-storage facilities there. What markets are you currently focused on when you're underwriting deals that you're looking at?
We'll look anywhere that's a good growing market in select states. So for example, in North Carolina, we'll look in Charlotte. I'll look in Winston-Salem, Greensboro, select parts of that area, that submarket, Raleigh, of course. We're looking in South Carolina, Florida, Texas, Arizona, Colorado, and obviously in Georgia and Tennessee. We just back from Knoxville, and we were looking at a deal out there this week. So those states, good growing markets within those states. Let's say, for example, we're looking at a deal in Houston, Texas. It doesn't have to be in the MSA, right? It doesn't have to be within Houston. It could be in a nice submarket of Houston.
Sure.
And that's where this deal is located. So that's totally fine with us. As long as there's growth there, as long as incomes can support storage, of course, and I don't be chasing rents. We just closed on one at March 1st of this year. Average household income, let's call it close to $100,000. Within 3 miles
wow,
of that facility. Yeah. Median is, you know, I forgot what the number is exactly, but they're pretty close together. Facility is 100% occupied as far as the units are concerned. And we have a ton of boat and RV out there. If you drive out there, you'll see like, you know, $200,000 parked there in the covered. That's another thing that also drives some of the storage is the parking as well. But there, that location, we don't chase. Everybody pays on time. They take care of their business. They're financially strong, of course. Those are the kind of markets we're looking in. Now, can we take a facility that's not doing so well and probably beat the other competitors around us, even if it's not in a quite as a desirable submarket or demographic? Yeah, but I would rather put my money in something like what we just closed in March. But also means it's competitive. So people like, I talked to some group yesterday, they were just wanting to get some input and whatnot. They're here local in Charlotte on stores. They had some land they're going to develop and probably do some storage there. And that's great. But I said to them, like, there's no new mousetrap in this business, right? Nobody's like found this golden thing, the fountain of youth when it comes to real estate investing or this anomaly that we're going to make a ton of money or whatever. Everybody else is looking in good markets. Everybody else is competing for the same, you know, deals for the most part. So you have to get creative on the financing and improve on the management side of things. You know, so you're paying high dollar in some cases for these locations. You're competing with REITs and others, you know, where they're looking at those large three-story deals and whatnot. But there's no new mousetrap. So we're looking in some of the markets that the other smart guys are looking in as well and competing against them. So that's where we are. That's where we're at.
Yeah. And just like the deal we just closed right before the show aired in Orlando, it's the relationships that come into it and how you find it. So I get that. So what are you like, what characteristics are you looking for in your deals today, Chris?
Yeah. If we can get to at least a minimum 30 to 40,000 square feet existing, that's where we want to be. If we can, if we can expand that and, you know, make it 60,000 total or something like that, that's great. It's an extra land, but it doesn't have to, because we think we can improve on the operations of the facility. Typically, if it's a mom and pop, they aren't doing tenant insurance, they aren't charging late fees, they aren't doing admin fees, some of those things. And that extra income can kind of make or break a deal sometimes, that including that with the debt financing and how that looks. So that's what we try to look for. We want to be in good markets where there's population growth. I won't go to a market or submarket where there's decline, but at the same time, sometimes you might look at a deal and in a 1 mile, there's population decline. In a 3 mile, when I say 1 or 3 mile, I mean like as the crow flies, like a radius around the facility. Yep. So if I go out to 3 miles, there's a population increase, and then 5 miles, there's an increase as well. But what happened in the 1 mile? Maybe it was because they didn't put in new housing. They put in a big retail shopping center, or they did something else. So just because it shows decline in the data, you have to kind of dig in and figure out, well, why is there decline in the market? Is it because of something like that? Rather than rooftops going in, they put in a retail thing or distribution warehouse thing, or, you know, Amazon or whatever. So, but we want to be in general, obviously, in a growing with population growth, with decent incomes in growing around those states I mentioned.
Yeah, tons of overlap with what we do on the multifamily side.
Tons of, like, we want a diverse economy, you know, because we want people moving in and out. We want people coming there because, like we just talked about earlier, that movement of people drives some of the demand for self-storage.
Absolutely. No, I love that. It definitely resonates, especially with, you know, some of the investors we work with. They understand that. And you talk through some of the areas, how you add value. Talk about the technology today and what we see. I've seen some of the self-storage facilities around here, and there's like a kiosk. There's nobody there, or there's very minimal staffing. What are we seeing, and how has the pandemic pushed some of these technological changes?
Yeah, that's a good point, because the pandemic has pushed operators to say, hey, how can we run these facilities with minimal staffing, in some cases, no staffing on site? Before, pre-pandemic, it was this big debate, and it kind of still is within the industry. If anybody's been around or kind of paid attention to it at all, there's always like a technology piece at any of the conferences you go to, or, you know, maybe some podcasts that you listen to. And it's like, hey, how do we help the on-site manager? This is pre-pandemic. We have an on-site manager, we pay them, you know, $40,000-$50,000 a year, and they're there full time. We might have one part-time person to kind of relief, you know, bring some relief to that full-time person on site. Those two people were about responsible for 400 units, you know, so that's a different thing in than compared to multifamily. In that case, with 400 units, you might need three or four people on site.
Absolutely.
So yeah, completely different. But in storage, you don't need as many. So it was a way, kiosks and all that, you know, we see them with the red box, you know, the DVDs and Blu-rays you can rent when you go to the grocery store, anywhere else. I mean, the airport, you know, whatnot, I just flew back in from Knoxville. There's nobody there taking a ticket, giving you change. It's all just, you know, a push button thing. Yeah. So absolutely, it has infiltrated the self-storage space, and it has been for quite some time. Tech does kiosks. They've been around for quite some time. There's a few others that do them and have rolled them out. iPads have gotten so good now that you can actually just use an iPad and it's cheap and just have it sitting there at the office when somebody walks in the door.
Yeah.
So that was pre-pandemic. How can we help the manager on site? We pay them a full-time salary, but we supplement with some technology. Maybe we might get it a little bit more fancy with some automated locking doors and whatnot and all this other stuff, which is great. During the pandemic, obviously, we couldn't have people on site. You know, I didn't want to walk in and talk to somebody. I wanted to just go rent a unit or want to go to the store. Go ahead.
Yeah. So stop right there. So you didn't have anybody on site during the pandemic. Is that what?
No, I'm saying operators in general, just in.
Okay, I gotcha.
So public storages and just different ones said, okay, we need to take our managers off site because of different, obviously the shutdowns and all that stuff. Well, we got to still rent units.
Yeah.
Right. Because life slowed down, but it didn't stop. And some people need space. So how do we do that? Well, we have a call center. They can go online, you know, that sort of thing. And then some operators realized, actually, you know what? Coming out of the pandemic, we actually don't need anybody on site full time. Like, we don't have to have that. We can actually have one person oversee two locations, you know, or something like that, and spread that person around. So back when I started at Within Storage, this is 2016 or so, we were doing everything manned. In some ways, we had like a little bit more technology than you really needed, I think. Yeah. So you can kind of go nuts with like automated locks and all this other stuff, but you don't have to have it. So at the facility we just closed in March, for example, there's no one on site. There never will be anyone on site. I don't want anybody on site. If you pull up, there's a sign that has our name of it off facility and a QR code. You want to rent, you can scan that code, take you right on your phone. Oof. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Your phone is now the kiosk.
And I love this. Like if you're listening, you're probably thinking, yeah, I get that, because we have our Airbnb. Everything's done remotely. You come up, you punch your code in, you enter. You never have to interact. These, like the storage centers that we're now implementing in our multifamily properties, you go in, there's a camera, you get your code, you get your box. People are like, well, hey, is this safe? Like, do I want my stuff sitting there? Well, it's really safe because you have facial recognition now a lot of times.
Yeah.
And you got to be pretty ballsy to go in there and take something and think that you're not going to get caught, because you have to have a code enter so they know who it is that enters. I heard a great, sorry to pause here, but I heard a great analogy talking about how there's less crime with Uber versus cabs, because you can track where everyone is, the driver and everything. So it actually drives crime down. So
interesting.
It's one of those things. It's kind of like a Freakonomics, you know, thought process, where even though there's less people involved, it's actually more secure in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's absolutely great. I love that. So with storage, you know, there's always things that can go wrong with technology. It's just not perfect. We've had people locked behind the gate, you know, nobody's on site. So like, what do you do? Well, you can always, there's a little latch you can flip and the gate can get out. But anyway, so there's things that can go wrong, of course.
Sure.
But
sure.
Is it worth paying someone $70,000 a year to have them on site to kind of that one thing that goes wrong? Not really. You know, I mean, if you think about it on a dollar per dollar basis, if I lose one customer because they got mad about something, is that still worth it? Off of having someone on site full time? No, it's not. Anyway, so that's a way to do it. And it's still like 10, you know, having no one on site. I've talked to other developers and asked them this very question, you know, what do you think about the unmanned operations, et cetera? And I've had them tell me, you know, you can never run a location as good without a person on site as you could with a person on site. I will never, you know, and they go on and on and on. It's like, hey, that's great. I just want to know a person's opinion. But if you ever heard that quote, if you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
You're right. Yeah.
So for you, you can't. That's your thing. Like, we're going to run our stuff unmanned as far as possible. Sometimes it gets a little difficult when you have like maybe a redevelopment. We were talking to our property manager and he said, you have a redevelopment of like a hotel and turn it into storage. There's all these nooks and crannies and it's really hard to direct people and direct traffic to find their unit. So we won't do that kind of thing. But storage is simple. If it's a simple thing with drive up and even three story and simple ways and all that, you don't need like people on site to go show a unit and all that.
Well, what's interesting, I spent 18 years in the medical device space, and pre-pandemic, I'm sitting there in the hospital, and it was actually in Greensboro, and they were putting up these little things on the wall. And I was like, what? I stopped the guy and I said, hey, you look like your typical tech guy. You know, he had like his phone holster and, you know, his shirt's all wrinkled. And I was like, hey, what are you doing? And it was an internal GPS for the hospital. So now they have an app in the hospital. So when you come in, you download the app and you know exactly where you are, and it guides you, you know, like a little mini Google Maps inside the hospital.
Yeah.
So as that technology improves, you're not even going to need these people to kind of direct, you know, around that site. It's pretty wild how that works. So Chris, talk a little bit about SIN.
Oh, the SIN Summit.
Yeah.
I know, that's so funny.
This is in Vegas. Where is this?
Yeah. The Storage Investor Nation Summit. We're going to have one coming up likely in October. We haven't locked down the dates just yet, but likely in October. We just had one April. We had a good lineup of speakers. So we hope to do even better than obviously the April one. The April one was our first one ever. So we had probably, I think it was like 25 plus speakers, industry veterans, data providers, brokers, management folks. So other acquisitions and development people. So the one in October should be really exciting. We hope to do a lot better and provide a ton of value. Usually it's a 2 or 3 day event. We're not sure if we're going to do 3 days this time or kind of condense everything into 2 days, but we'll see how that goes. But we also do weekly webinars, Storage Investor Nation webinars, and we put our information on that for the Storage Investor Nation Summit. So if you want to find out more, they can always visit storageinvestornation.com and find out more about our summits, that's the summit and our weekly webinars.
Outstanding. And yeah, if you're listening, you're probably a subscriber to the Next Level Income Show. If you're not, go to our website, nextlevelincome.com. Make sure you subscribe. You'll get updates on the self-storage summit, the SIN summit that's coming up. And then Chris, we really appreciate you being on the show today, talking about a lot of the things that our audience has become accustomed to in terms of why self-storage is going to be such a terrific space, not only today, but also going forward. Before we let you go today, we always ask our guests, if you can go back to your 25-year-old self and give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be?
I would think connect with other investors at that time. So sometimes you don't know what you don't know. And when I was doing real estate, all I saw was the foreclosure side of the business. I didn't know. I remember reading Robert Kiyosaki's book, but that was like around 2009 or so, something like that. So it was a little bit later. Still didn't quite grasp the concept of investing in rental properties and the opportunity that was in front of me at that time. So I would have probably, if I can go back now, I would definitely say, hey, go find other investors who are doing this very thing and buy everything you possibly
at that everything.
Time. Yeah.
Fully leveraged. No, I love it. And hey, listen, your story was you living that when you were talking about, you know, going to that meetup and meeting Dan, and here we are today having this conversation as you guys are now partners and we're looking at some deals coming up. So Chris, thank you so much for being on the show today. If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to find out?
They can shoot me an email, Chris, K-R-I-S at passiveinvesting.com.
We love Chris's around here, so we appreciate you being on the show today, Chris. And check out Chris's upcoming blog on our website if you haven't been there, nextlevelincome.com. Thanks for being on today.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Hey, Chris here again. I hope you found this episode valuable. Now, I have one more thing to gift you. We have a page for my coaching clients where you can get a free copy of my book, as well as much more from previous guests on the show. Just check out nextlevelincome.com/coaching to get a free copy of my book, audiobook, and much more. I'll send you a copy of my book and cover all the shipping costs as a thank you for listening to the podcast. Also, please like, share, and take just 90 seconds to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts.